You're listening to Crime Friction.
That could change at any moment.
Baby crowds run. So is love. If you do neither one of them right, you're wearing a glove. Crime Friction.
So previously on Crime Friction, we had a really long chat about cinema and Hollywood and Jurassic World and the presentation of heroes, and I'm rambling, and why there's no, we seem scared to just have fun and be positive and give ourselves permission to have fun and be positive.
And, you know, that's something that I'm seeing online a lot recently. You know, we live in a hard time. And it's hard to be on social media and it's hard to engage. You know, sometimes the issues that we want to talk about, we don't know how to talk about. And we're working behind the scenes to make things better. But it's not something that we, even as writers, have the emotional bandwidth to verbalize sometimes. And so I see so many people who are eager to take a negative stance. And I don't mean just politically, but on culture, on people, on things. And I'm certainly not a positive person on the whole. I'm not a happy person. But I try to make sure that I don't put more negativity out there. I mean, don't we have enough? Mm-hmm. I think letting them know how to make a positive change, or saying hang in there and, you know, here to help, is so much better.
I generally don't like talking about call-out culture, because I think it's often complaining about something that is good is that we've reached a stage when if someone's seeing someone being racist or transphobic or sexist or whatever, that they will be called out for it. And I have no issue with that. I support that. That people almost looking to other people in the room and going, I don't think you're doing enough. Or I don't think you're depressed enough. I don't think you're as depressed as I am. I don't think you're struggling as much as I am. And we all are. And we're all finding our own ways to try and get through it. And we need, I think one of the most radical things we can do right now is to try and find things to laugh about and be happy about and be positive about. And remind other people that it's okay to do those things.
And that's not to say that we need to ignore the problems that are out there, but it's just, you know, life is a myriad of emotions every day, every hour, every moment. It's not just one. So it's not like today is just going to be sad. There might be a thing that makes you laugh. And you know what? That's a wonderful thing. And so share that thing with the other people and make them laugh too, so they have one positive moment in their day.
I mean, some of the people I know who are doing the most about, you know, whatever issue, insert issue here, the people I know who are doing the most are doing it privately.
Exactly.
In whatever means they can. And some people have more resources than others. Some people can make a big difference. Some people can make a small difference. But I don't know anyone who isn't trying, but it's not necessarily going to be doing it publicly.
And hand in hand with that, I think that there's a level of, you know, social media is a great thing as far as it's perfect, you know, to have those opportunities to call people out, to call issues out, to spread the word about where we need to shine a light, right? It's wonderful for all of that. But at the same time, it's given humanity a level of, I'm going to search for the right word and you're going to cut until I find it. It's given them a level of empowerment or endorsement as far as their feelings go. People often confuse an emotional reaction with a considered opinion on something.
Yeah, it's the two have become the same thing, and they shouldn't be, because don't like is valid. It's, we all do it.
It's perfectly fine. Yeah.
We all, you know, you like,
but
coffee,
I think we also need to know why.
Coffee, whatever, and that's, you know, you like pop music, you don't, whatever it is, it's perfectly fine. That's a very short conversation. I like this, I don't like it. Okay, cool. But if you're going to put in the extra work,
right,
then to look into the reasons why things work, why they don't work, or why you think they don't work, that's a different conversation. And I don't think at the moment that we kind of, we recognize that it's two different things, and we end up having arguments because we're not separating the two. And the emotion boils over and kind of steamrollers everything.
I mean, I don't know. Maybe I'm well, I know I'm insane. but don't you have things where, like, yes, I know it's bad, but I liked it? Or yes, I know it's good, but I couldn't stand it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
I can separate those two things. And I know the difference. And I'll be glad to say, hey, I understand that this movie that you really love, it's a great movie. I just personally didn't like it. Yes. Here's what didn't resonate with me. Here's why it's good. And, you know, just because I don't like something doesn't mean it's not good. Mm-hmm. It's I don't like it. That's why it's subjective. That's why it's an opinion. But also, you know, I think as I expect a little bit more from our peers, you know, writers, creators, in looking at other pieces of culture and going beyond. I expect them as people in a craft to go beyond that I liked, didn't like.
Yeah.
Because there are pieces of art. Like if you look at a piece of art, visual arts, you know, paintings are even more subjective than what we do. And, you know, I worked in the art world. I have a degree in art history. And I know that there are things where once I know the background of a painting, I'll go, I appreciate this, right? Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean I like it or want to hang it on my wall.
But also, I mean, to take it back again, you also have to recognize that when you are having the like, don't like reaction, which I have a lot now, I've recognized that a lot of my reactions are like, don't like, recognize that what it is, and that there's a time to step back and to just go, okay, that's what my reaction is. I'm not gonna carry this whatever emotion I'm feeling, whether it's whether it's anger at something, resentment at something, whether I really didn't like it. I'm not gonna carry that over into the next conversation. I'm not gonna take that out on a conversation about this other element of craft or whatever. Just recognize what you're feeling when you're feeling it, and apply appropriately.
And, you know, there's so many things, like I said, you know, social media validates all of these opinions. You know, there are certain opinions that don't need more than a like, don't like. And you point this out frequently. And I agree. You know, we're adults. We can like a thing or not like a thing without explaining why. Mm. But when you have so many people shouting, this is a bad thing, this is a good thing, this is a bad thing, these like, don't likes get conflated in levels of importance with the rest of the issues.
The thing recently when they announced or they showed the images of a new Thundercats show, mm-hmm. and the internet... Oh, sorry.
Thundercats!
I hate to use a generalization of the internet. The usual suspects on the internet just lost their shit completely with hate and anger that our youth is being destroyed, you know, and that it's Thundercats is the most important thing right now. And no, it isn't. It was a cool 80s cartoon. If we rewatched it as adults, it's probably not very good. We love it because we watched it when we were kids. You know, we have an emotional attachment to it. Let's let a new generation of kids have an emotional attachment to it. The end. It doesn't... If you're fighting to the death over that, and then the next day you're angry over, you know, immigration policy, it gets hard to separate the noise, and it gets hard to get up for the fights that need to be got up for.
Well, and I mean, it's not like it's Gem and the Holograms in that remake where there were no fucking holograms in the Gem and the Holograms movie. Like this is a hill I will die on.
There are at least some Thundercats in the new Thundercats.
Right? Like, they're so far ahead of the game as far as, you know, not ruining the childhood goes. So, you know, just I guess our point is, if we have one, which would be a surprise even to me, you know, try to do good. You know, don't put somebody else's thing down just because you can and just because it's out there. And, you know, spread the positive. Tell us what you like. You know, hey, I just watched this great movie. I just read this great thing. I can't wait for this reboot. You know, share the positivity so that we can all take a moment of joy in this really shit time.
And I think we can end this on a good example. Our friend Krista Faust, who will be on this show at some point, every now and then when things online get really bad, she starts a meme of posting things that don't suck. That's where she hashtags it, things that don't suck. And it's just a chance for people to share pictures and links to dumb, fun, sexy or exciting or funny, whatever you need in the moment, just something you enjoy. And I think that we shouldn't, that shouldn't be something we only do when things get bad. That should just be something that we try and do all the time, so that then when things get bad, we've got the mental energy that we need to go and deal with the bad thing, because the rest of the time we're just having fun.
And you know us, we're just always fun.
Fun 24/7.
Yeah, it's always a party on Selena Kyle's answering machine.
So who's our guest this week?
Chris Farnsworth is a novelist, screenwriter, and journalist. He is the author of Flash Mob, Kill File, and The Eternal World, as well as the President's Vampire series and the comic book 24 Legacy Rules of Engagement. His books have been translated into 9 languages, published in more than a dozen countries, and optioned for film and television. His writing has also been published by the LA Times and the New York Post, The Owl, spelled with an A, and The New Republic. He lives in Los Angeles with his wife and daughters, and you can find more at ChristopherFarnsworth.com.
And he invented the television.
Basically, yeah.
Okay, over to Chris. No, not him on his own. Okay, over to us talking. Okay. Okay, over to the interview.
Let's just turn on the television.
Mm-hmm.
Crime fiction. I actually really love your blog because you talk about things that I talk about at length that nobody really wants to talk with me about, like WKRP in Cincinnati.
I
was saying to Jay, I'm like, I could go for years on this topic. That was a great show.
That was, it's a fantastic, one of the best sitcoms of all time. Absolutely.
Well,
you are totally right about that.
And they dealt with so many issues in a very lighthearted, subtle manner that made a difference.
Yeah. In a very smart way. And yeah, the writing was really superb. And I mean, yeah, it's amazing what they were able to do. And shows like that and Barney Miller All in the Family, the 70s were just a golden age for sitcoms.
Well, and you know, the heir apparent, I think, to WKRP in Cincinnati is Night Court, really.
Yes, yes, you and me right there. That's exactly.
And I've been meaning to write a post about Night Court because the judge is kind of a lighthearted but noir hero. You know, he doesn't know who his parents are.
Right.
You know, he's had issues with mental health.
Mm-hmm.
He ends up here. So you have and often makes choices that he thinks are for the good that end up in a bad spot for him and the people around him.
Right.
But you don't really look at it that way because it's so lighthearted. And I've been rewatching it, especially since Harry Anderson passed away.
Right.
And I thought, you know, I'm going to go back through. And I know that Jay has been the recipient of several texts like, I'm watching season 2. And then I'll list, you know, they deal with like transgender issues and
right.
and all of and I had forgotten a lot of these big topics. And I don't think a show has done that in quite that smooth a fashion since WKRP in Cincinnati.
They made it wacky. So that people wouldn't have to think about it too much. But yeah, there's the episode, yeah, where Herb meets his old friend from high school and she's a woman now.
Oh, yeah, I remember that one.
Yeah, and he's got to deal with that, you know, and it's an episode that was aired in, like, what, the early 80s? So, yeah, it's incredible. It's groundbreaking.
There does seem to have been... I've got another friend recently who I think it's Hulu that you guys have over there, isn't it? That's a service you have in that America that they have now.
Over there.
He was rewatching ER, I think. I've been kind of seeing his posts on Facebook, sometimes joining in as he's gone through this. He's done something like 300 episodes in 2 months or whatever the number is for ER. He's just gone through all of them.
Wow.
And he was saying very early on that ER was doing stuff. We do identity stuff now, that the trans issues and all of that. Like we're seeing that and we're fighting for that to be done now. But it does feel like there was a point in the 80s and early-ish 90s when that was in pop culture. And we've kind of forgotten that something happened and it went away, and then pop culture became very kind of laddish and vanilla and safe again for a while. And we're kind of at the other end of that cycle now when we're doing it again. But for some reason, it seems like somewhere in the late 90s and then the early 2000s, it all went away. And I don't really know why.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that part of that might have to do with the rise of cable in the United States. You have the ability of everyone to suddenly have their own channel of whatever they wanted. So specialized content rose up. And so I think you maybe the networks moved to try to get the broadest possible audience.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, it's I think that you've seen, yeah, a sort of return to talking about stuff that used to be part of the everyday conversation.
And I just did a Google search because I was curious about the years of the shows.
Mm-hmm.
WKRP was 78 to 82.
Right.
Night Court was 84 to 92.
Right.
And then ER was 94 to 2009.
Yeah.
Oh, so there's this continuum. Yeah.
Exactly. But WKRP and Night Court were both very diverse in its cast at the time, at least more than many of the shows then and even today are.
I think that's absolutely right.
In sitcom terms, I've always kind of looked at it I've always kind of blamed Friends. Because I loved sitcoms before Friends, and you had Taxi, and you had interesting casts, even not,
yes.
even not diverse, just interesting casts.
And then it became characters. Monotonous.
And suddenly everyone was young and beautiful and pretty, and one line is every other word, and it stopped being funny and it stopped being interesting. And again, we're at the other end of that cycle now, when you can find sitcoms that are funny and diverse and interesting, but. Yeah, I'm just going to blame Friends. I'm going to say it was Friends.
Well, actually, you could back up just slightly farther and maybe even blame Seinfeld.
Right, that was the mantra of Larry David: no hugging, no learning.
Right.
Yeah. Nobody's gonna come out of this a better person. And then at the end of the show, you see, I will speak up for Friends in this way. I think it is a great sitcom, and I have the unpopular opinion that it is a better sitcom than Seinfeld. That the characters are more fully developed, especially in the first years, and that it's just funnier. That while Seinfeld is really funny, that nobody goes back and rewatches Seinfeld over and over and over, the same way that they do Friends. I will agree with you, though, that Friends totally turned. There were no more ugly people on sitcoms Friends.
Yeah.
TV ugly. I mean, this is the great thing, actually, about living in Los Angeles. You see these people who are supposed to be, you know, considered homely on television or in movies. And they're beautiful. They're gorgeous. They're just, you realize they're just normal people.
Mm-hmm.
Normal people on TV, when you compare them to the goddesses and gods they have to work with, look kind of homely. which is, you know, a thing, yeah, which is really great for my self-esteem on a daily basis. After Friends, you stopped seeing people do jobs like cab drivers. You know, they didn't do jobs, you know, like DJ in a failing radio station in Cincinnati. Those things were considered kind of depressing. Instead, you had these young, you know, attractive people doing these amazing things. Like at one point, aside from Seinfeld, every show on NBC's Thursday Night lineup was a Friends clone. And it was just, you know, just wall-to-wall pretty people. Dialing it back to my original premise, Friends was funnier than Seinfeld. Seinfeld, if you watch it over and over again, as I have, you know, you see that it's really just, it was, by not being about anything, it was nothing but, you know, really kind of snide jokes.
I do,
which,
I mean,
and nothing, there's anything wrong with that.
I think
we
might agree on that. You can't binge watch Seinfeld. I've tried it. I will regularly rewatch it, but you'll do. Once you get to sort of the halfway through a third episode in a row, you think, I'm done now. You put it away for a couple of weeks. So there is that. You probably binge watch something like Friends in a way that you just can't do with Seinfeld. And it, I think it might
but
be
right.
that
well,
buildup of the different kind of humor. It's not binge.
Yeah. Also, I think that the difference you see with Seinfeld and Friends, and I mean the difference I think between a really great sitcom and one that's just, you know, just funny, just, you know, stuff happens and you laugh and then you put it away. And your mileage may vary on, but for me, it's the difference between character and caricature.
Mm-hmm.
And this isn't my theory. It's Todd Vanderwerf from The Onion and The AV Club. It's the difference between the early Simpsons seasons and the later ones, because at a certain point, you know, you you stop, you know, in the early ones, you're like, oh, Homer really cares about Lisa and he's trying to be a good father, even though he's a complete clod. And in the later seasons, you're just like, oh, this is just something that happened that nobody's going to care about.
Yeah.
And that's where I think you have the same divide between Friends and Seinfeld. At a certain point, eventually the characters on Friends devolved into caricatures, yes, as it happens with pretty much any successful sitcom, where stuff just happens to them and you're just flinging, you know, you're just flinging jokes at the audience, and just like monkeys throwing poop at the wall just to see what happens. At the beginning, you're like, well, I can be sort of invested in the emotional struggles of these people because they're trying to make their lives work, as opposed to Seinfeld, where it's like, let's have Kramer come through the door and then let's have them trapped in a Chinese restaurant, you know, waiting for a table, and let's just see what happens. And that's how, you know,
through the door really well. You have to.
He did. He came through the door really well. And I will maintain too that the contest is one of the funniest sitcom episodes of all time. That's genius. Oh. That alone gets them in the Hall of Fame. I mean,
I think that what was brilliant about Seinfeld is really exactly what was also wrong with it, and why you feel it's not sustainable. It is a parody of all of these moments of life that we kind of, you know, truly do happen to us, put the focus on the nonsense. And nobody had really ever done it to that degree. You know, things were, oh, this is a family, oh, it's relatable in that way. But as far as, you know, moment to moment, you know, these were pastiches of life's weird, you know, ridiculous moments. Mm-hmm.
It's a good way I think about it is it's being forced to look at the astroturf on the Brady Bunch. It's like, we all know that it's not really a family. They're not really in a home, but it's breaking the suspension of disbelief if you notice that their lawn is made of astroturf.
I think my favorite, I'm conflicted with Seinfeld a little bit, just I love it, but one of my favorite episodes, I rewatched it recently and realized that as me in 2018, I don't think I'm allowed to like the episode.
Right.
Because it's the one with the restaurant across the road that's, and I can't remember which ethnicity it's supposed to be now. But it's
a guy
who isn't that ethnicity, you know, with makeup on and playing a role. And it's funny because it's the one when Seinfeld is giving him advice and Seinfeld keeps congratulating himself for having the idea and thinking, I'm such a wonderful person, even though he's ruining this.
Right. I'm such
life.
A nice guy. Right, I'm such a good guy.
And that's funny, that all of that is funny. It's just as I was watching it, I was clenched teeth thinking, I don't think I can like this anymore.
Right. I run into that all the time. Totally.
What about Newhart?
Sitcoms are not meant
Bob
to be.
Newhart show.
Oh yeah. God, they're amazing. Bob Newhart is one of the best comedians of all time, and
I agree.
I will fight and die on that hill.
And I will be beside you.
Yeah, I think it's just genius is not too strong a word. And I mean, that shouldn't be a controversial opinion by any means. Like, Bob Newhart's a great comedian. Really? Oh my gosh. Next you're going to say child abuse is bad. Oh no.
I do know a lot of people who, I think that the dryness, and some of the subtleties in his humor, are a little bit lost and they just find him a little bit boring.
He was subverting all of those cliches and putting them on their head. The guy, you know, he would talk about, you know, he would talk in a very subversive way about ad executives twisting the truth and taking these things we think of eternal verities and nobility and just turning them into more PR, like when he has a PR man with the publicist talking to Abe Lincoln.
I love that.
That's, you know, especially for the time at which he was working, that's an incredibly subversive and smart and funny and snarky bit.
Yeah, let's remember to put that in the show notes somewhere. haven't heard that because, you know.
Oh, it's phenomenal.
You mentioned that to me as if I'm going to be doing that.
Well, no, but you're going to hear this again. And it will make you remember by the fact that I said it.
Remember to tell you to do it. Got it.
Exactly.
Remember to tell me to.
And I mean, truly, one of, if not the, at least to me, most iconic moments in Newhart, the series finale.
Yes.
That was no one had really ever done anything. You know, we talk generationally differently, you know, Sopranos and going to Black, you know, and mm-hmm. that was, oh my goodness, that was controversial. Yes. You know, how we have to maybe think for ourselves. We don't know exactly who died or did they live, you know,
right.
Screen went to Black. It's happened. I did not have these immense feelings about this. But other
right. It was not an existential crisis for me.
No. But, you know, in Newhart, waking up in the Bob Newhart show and that entire, you know, how many year span was a dream was
right.
Brilliant.
Yeah. That was brilliant. Have you read Nell Scovell's Just the Funny Parts?
No, yes? I haven't.
It's fantastic. Jay, have you read it yet?
No, I haven't.
It's a memoir by Nell Scovell, who wrote for Spy Magazine and Letterman and Newhart and The Muppets. And, I mean, she's just incredibly prolific and incredibly funny. She created the TV version of Sabrina the Teenage Witch, and she wrote for Warehouse 13. But she writes about, you know, being a woman in comedy and in Hollywood, you know, over the last 30-some, you know, years. And how she's faced everything through her career. And it's a fantastic book. But she writes about her time on Newhart and about the finale and just how amazingly groundbreaking that seemed at the time.
Well, and it really was, because, you know, now we go on about, you know, the Tommy Westfall universe. But
right.
But in a way, this was a predecessor of that.
And
I think it was brilliant, and I'm sure that it had a lot of the same, you know, reaction of the Sopranos going to Black in the, oh my God, you're kidding, you did that. I'm sure a lot of people at the time didn't like it, and as many other people, you know, maybe hadn't watched the Bob Newhart show. So I'm sure it was, you know, like, what the hell just happened? I still prefer the Bob Newhart show. And as far as, you know, breaking ground, Newhart was definitely more of a traditional sitcom. And I felt like the biggest difference was the way he treated his wife in both shows.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Suzanne Pleshette in Bob Newhart was definitely a partner. You know, she worked outside of the home. They discussed major issues and choices and things like, you know, infertility and adoption. And it was a very much, you know, equal household, especially for that earlier time. And then we got into, you know, the early to mid 80s, and Joanna on Newhart was definitely in a subordinate role, I felt, to Bob in that situation. So to me, that was, you know, a bigger difference. And I don't know if it's seen that shift that we were talking about from, you know, WKRP to Night Court to, you know, whatever came next. But that seemed to be just on the cusp as far as Bob Newhart show dealt with issues and mental illness and, you know, in a very funny and subtle way. And definitely tongue in cheek and over the top. But we never really had that come up at all in Newhart.
I think you're right. I think that I've never really thought about it, but I think you're absolutely right in that. And there was, I think, Jay, like you were saying, there was a sort of rollback in all sitcoms and all pop culture and all entertainment that started in the 80s. And, I mean, you can trace that to the rise of conservatism in, you know, both America and England, but, you know, with Reagan and Thatcher. I think you see... You know, you saw people were like, we're going back to old fashioned values. And you saw the rise of like the Parents Resource Council and focus and Falwell's group. What were they called? The ones who would scream, what about the children? Every time that there was something they didn't like on television. In the 70s, you didn't have as much of that.
So the money bit. See, that's how you do it.
So this week we're putting a spotlight on Unloaded Volume 2, More Crime Writers Writing Without Guns. The Anthony-nominated collection of crime stories without guns, the collection we didn't want to be necessary, is back for Volume 2. 24 more crime writers have come together to raise their voices and take pen in hand to call for a sensible and reasoned debate about guns in America. As the mass shootings continue, the avoidable accidents, the suicides, the gun violence that consumes our country rolls on unabated and unaddressed by our leadership, other than to say, now is not the time to discuss it. These crime writers have chosen to start the dialogue. In stories of crime, mystery, and suspense, these authors have left the guns out to show for a short while that we can do without them and the plot doesn't fall apart. Maybe in a small way, we can show that the American way of life doesn't cease to be either.
And I'd like to give a special shout out to Eric Buettner for using his and many of the author's creativity in order to make a positive and creative stance in this world, because it is the books, it is the creatives, it is the art that shows us the things we need to see and the things that we need to change. And so thanks, Eric, for being the change we want to see in the world.
Absolutely. Best-selling authors like Chris Holm, Laurie Rader Day, Bill Kreider, Laura McHugh, James Ziskin, and John Rector, along with many more. I'd just like to point out that my official author title does tend to be many more. Joined together to call for an end to the needless violence and start a reasonable debate.
Mm-hmm. That's also your stripper name.
And back to Chris.
I think the first time I noticed it, the first time I became aware of it, was through music, because, I mean, growing up, I was in bands. I loved music, and I loved, particularly, I loved things like punk, and I was big into the history of it. And I was a teenager in the 90s, and I was playing music in the 90s. But looking back to music from the past, that was where I was getting my inspiration from. And I just started to notice that the music I was looking at in the past, the history with punk and new wave, or you know, insert genre, any of it, was incredibly diverse, and often, you know, almost all of them were led by various minority groups and then co-opted, and, you know, it steadily becomes bland. But the history of all of these pop cultures was incredibly diverse, with women in punk bands and with people of color in two-tone and just all of it. But then the pop culture music that my friends were in bands playing and that we were listening to on the radio in the 90s, all of a sudden, all of that went away, and it was Blur versus Oasis. It was Britpop. It was white people who'd been to art college. It was just somewhere. There was a line in the sand that I could never trace. But music was incredibly diverse, and then it was incredibly white, and I could never figure it out. Except that anytime I tried to have the conversation with my friends, you know, I'd get shut down for being a crazy liberal, but it was just like, what's happened? Where has everybody gone? Yeah, by the 90s, you absolutely do see that sort of homogenization, this sort of, you know, you wonder, and yeah, you wonder what the turning point was.
To bring it a little bit to comedy as well, in comedy at the time, you could see that, I'm only speaking from the UK point here, although I know stand-up comedy in the US, but I was just experiencing, you know, firsthand in the UK, so I can speak for that. There was the culture of being, that we then got stuck in for a long time, of being ironically old-fashioned. It was this thing of, we're going to bring back these fake old values, the conservatism, but we're going to do it ironically. So we're pretending that we're being funny while we're being racist and sexist, and while we're excluding people. And that just kind of then settled in and became the norm. And it wasn't ironic. It was an excuse.
Yeah, just, I mean, speaking of problematic faves, you know, like Andrew Dice Clay and Sam Kinison, you saw a lot of, it's like, these guys, we're joking, but we're really not. Mm-hmm. We're saying these things that are taboo against the great PC, and we still get that today, but, you know, but where people say, oh, we're speaking out against being politically correct, and it's just, it's, I don't know, it's kind of it's a tiresome way to be funny. It's like, I'm being...
And there were some groundbreaking things that both the comics you just mentioned did, but at the same time, I don't think that, you know, we were talking about, you know, you go back and watch Friends or Seinfeld or something, and there are stand-ups that I watch over and over and over. You don't see a lot of people who are, you know, rewatching or re-listening to Andrew Dice Clay nowadays.
No, yeah, no,
it was very of the moment.
Yeah, that was what sold at the time.
I just had the opportunity to edit Les Edgerton's memoir, and he grows up, you know, in 40s, 50s, 60s, partially in the South. And so there's definitely a lot of, and he speaks, you know, firsthand about racial tensions, all of this, especially the young people. And as far as the culture goes, it was more like, oh, we haven't been exposed to this. And the minute, you know, the teenagers, they were eager to explore something new and something different. Right. And the culture would change accordingly. I mean, we wouldn't, Elvis Presley comes strongly out of a, you know, soul and gospel music background. And then how many people did he influence? But going from that to your point, Jay, at a point, it was like the teenagers, the young kids who were creating their tastes, you know, weren't exploring like they used to.
Mm-hmm. And so, and at some point, rebellion became, for a while, became about rebelling, maybe because so much good, so many good advances have been made, and, you know, so many of the people above us or above whoever, whichever age group it was who did it, the people they looked up and saw as parents and parents' figures had made so much progress that, in a way, the rebellion became against that. And it was, you know...
Absolutely. You absolutely see... It's like, you know, it's like young women today who say, well, I'm not a feminist. And it's like, well, okay, but, you know, you're allowed to vote. that's something feminists did. That's something feminists fought and
bled and died
for.
You are standing on the back of...
Right.
You know, you are lucky that you get to make the choice that you are or are not, or how you identify, because, you know, the only reason that you have that ability is because of the people who went before and made these strides.
Right. In my lifetime, my mom was not allowed to get a credit card because she was a single mom, and she, you know, and women were not allowed to have credit cards. They just weren't. It's, you know, we can't give you a credit card because, you know, you're a woman. And what do you, and in my lifetime, she was fired from her job as a flight attendant because she got married. And they told her, we can't have married women as flight attendants because then who's going to want to date you?
Wow.
You know, it's, and there was, years long class action lawsuit. Yeah, she's pretty tough.
It just makes you think there's times when to get some of the progress that's been made, I don't want to get too deep here, but to get some of the progress that's been made in society, there've had to be people standing up who, in effect, were actually standing up against the law at times, and against the prevailing culture, but against the law, against things that the law allowed, you know, various things against, you know, people of color or women or whatever. Someone's had to stand up and say, not only am I being treated wrong, but I actually think the law is wrong. I think the culture is wrong. And that's an incredibly difficult position to have to take.
I think that goes back to what we were talking about earlier with the commoditization of culture. You know, you have all of these people today who say stuff like, well, Martin Luther King wouldn't have knelt at the side of an NFL game. It's like, who do you think Martin Luther King was? It's easy to put on these sort of nostalgia-tinted glasses and forget that men like Martin Luther King Jr. were hated for the steps that they took to end what was our own system of, you know, apartheid. And they were considered agitators and communists and rabble-rousers. And if everything would be fine if these guys just would, you know, stop stirring things up. And now, you know, 50, 60 years later, you have people saying, the same people saying that, well, you should be more like Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., as if the progress would have happened without men and women like that.
I think people can be nice and liberal, and sometimes because you think you're on the side of the big issues, you don't always realize that you're also part of the problem. I saw so many people who would, on the one hand, would kind of share memes about Tommy Smith and John Carlos and the 68 salute and how wonderful it was, but then the same people would be criticizing an athlete now kneeling.
In decades prior, and I'm going to sound like kids get off my lawn with this, but I think social media has a lot to do with this lackadaisical attitude. You know, we can put on Twitter, oh, you know, racism is wrong, you know, and then, oh, look at us, we've made a difference in the cause, we feel, you know. people would have to march. People would have to, you know, get up and do something, you know, make a sign, do a thing. And often they would get blamed. You know, they might lose a job. They might, you know, their family would have backlash, you know, if they were the ones standing up. Now it's like, oh, somebody doesn't like what you say. You can block them on social media or, you know, close down your account. And, oh, now it's all gone away. And I can keep going about my daily life. And this issue doesn't affect me.
I think that, I did a real, you know, I did a real deep dive into social media and so, and public shaming for Flash Mob, my last book. And he said, plugging. And, but I think that this goes to both of your points, that we have these blind spots that we never see. And the first, and when our bubbles get punctured, it's uncomfortable and it's painful. I mean, you know, I just got up on my soapbox there about Dr. Martin Luther King, but I have huge blind spots. I have, enormous, you know, gaps in my knowledge that I have not yet filled. And there are certainly times when I am not as empathetic or as kind or as smart as I should be about all of this stuff. There are people suffering in ways that I will thankfully never have to experience. I've been extraordinarily lucky in my life. And it's painful and it's hard when those bubbles get popped. And I think people instinctively recoil from that experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've said it before, but I think that, you know, social media has become our nervous system. And right now, it's just screaming in pain. It's like a newborn. And when you're a newborn, you know, from my experience with my daughters, if something hurts you, you have nothing to do except scream. And so right now, that's all social media is most of the time. It's just screaming at the top of our lungs that something's wrong and I don't like it.
Something that I became a bit kind of self-aware about as I was growing up, because now I'm all grown up, I have no more progress left to make. when I was growing up, was that I realized that as nice as I try to be, and as liberal and understanding and modern as I try to be, there's still something in my wiring that my first response, and this relates right back to things you've been saying about, you know, social media having kind of being people kind of calling out in pain, and to an extent that my first response deep down when I encounter things I don't know, there's a part of me that the first response is to scoff, is to just inbuilt crack a joke at its expense. And that, if you're not aware of that, and if you don't kind of take control of that and think, right, I'm gonna make the effort not to be that person, then your first response when you encounter new ethnic groups or new gender identities or new whatever will be to do that. And then, you know, 5 minutes after that, you might be having a wonderfully in-depth conversation when you've listened to what's being said to you and you understand the points. But what we'll see on social media is that first reaction is the scoff or the joke. I was talking
or the nervous laughter.
Or the
so
nervous
this is
laughter,
different.
Yeah.
And I don't get it. And it freaks
exactly.
me out.
And that's what
and I'm
see,
uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But also, don't you think that it goes to, you know, the internet makes everyone feel like not only are their opinions valid, but at the same time, an equally valid response is, I don't have enough data to answer this question. I haven't been exposed to it enough. And I don't know if it's because the internet is so tied to marketing and products. You know, everybody wants our opinion about a product, or, you know, you're going to target an ad to this because, you know, our opinions have shown certain things. So everything that we're shown or sold relates back in some way to our opinion, which is a, you know, self-validating cycle. But also, you know, especially during the last election, they did a lot of online studies, and they're saying, you know, more people, you know, you're only surrounding yourself on people in social media who think like you do. You know, people were, and so there was a lack of being shown those other opinions because you are validating yourself by only surrounding yourself with people who are going to like or think the same thing that you do.
You live in, there was a great article in the New York, Wall Street Journal,
right,
where the Wall Street Journal showed you the feeds of a conservative and the feeds of a liberal, and they were two completely different worlds. They weren't even describing the same events, but the same facts didn't enter into it anywhere.
Mm-hmm. But you're able to weed out those people who think or will show you a different viewpoint much more easily online than you are in life.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And online, and that's actually the point of online.
Yeah.
That's the point of social media, is to hear what you want to hear, to select only the channels you want to get, and narrow your range of input to just what makes you comfortable. It's, I don't know, I'm reminded of, you know, when I was a reporter, there was one of my favorite movies was The Paper, the one with Michael Keaton and Robert Duvall.
I love that movie.
And at one point, Robert...
Yeah, that's one of Jay's favorites.
I love that movie.
It's one of my absolute favorite movies of all time.
Yes,
one of my really good friends is now the editor of the New York Post, and he and I bonded over our love of that movie, and now he's running, you know, the Post. But yeah, and on his birthday, I send him Michael Keaton's, you know, rant to the editor of the New York, mm-hmm. the New York Times. But there's that great scene where Robert Duvall says we have a business columnist, we have a Metro columnist, we have this columnist, that columnist. We have too much opinion, Henry. And, you know, we reek of opinion. And, yeah, opinion is cheap. Opinion is easy. Anybody can have an opinion. Reporting is hard. Getting the facts is hard. My editors, when I was a reporter, always hated opinions. They're like, you don't get to write a column until you've actually done the reporting.
Yeah.
It's really easy to miss that, to miss getting the facts before you start going off.
But now let's talk about The Paper. So...
Yeah. One of the greatest movies of all time.
I love
absolutely.
There's a scene on the rooftop that I the scene blew my mind the first time I watched it, and it always does, of when Keaton goes to Robert Duvall for advice, and Robert Duvall has to turn around and say, the problem with being my age is that people think you're a father figure, but you're the same asshole you always were.
Yes, yeah. And he says, it's not my job to help you solve your problems. My job is to keep you down there in Metro.
Yes.
You're coming to the wrong guy.
I think he has the line, you have a problem, Henry, but it's your problem.
We can just sit here and recite the whole thing to one another all day. It's fantastic.
Also, I know a fair amount of people who really don't like that film. You know, don't understand them, but I know them.
Yeah, I can't. You just stunned me. You stopped me cold. What? How can no? Really?
Since we talked about it so much, or talked around it so much, why don't you give a little plug for Flash Mob, since it's relevant to our discussion today?
Yeah,
sure. Well, Flash Mob is the story of a former psychic soldier, a guy who was trained by the named John Smith, a guy who was trained by the U.S. Army to use his psychic abilities for the good of the country, and then decided he could make a lot more money going on his own. And what he's done now is he's been hired by a billionaire to look into a hate site on the internet called Downvote that's actually targeting people and sending online and real life mobs after them and trying to kill them. And so what Smith discovers is that there's this shadowy, you know, internet genius out there who's essentially learned how to weaponize social media and can use it to move crowds to do whatever he likes. And when I wrote it, I thought it would be fiction, but as it turns out, not so much. the same methods that I talk about in the book turn out to be exactly what Russian hackers and Cambridge Analytica were using Facebook to do, to target people who were on the cusp of making decisions and enrage them and poke them and make them afraid and angry and affect their mood with something that psychologists call emotional contagion. And as it turns out, it's a lot closer to reality than I thought or anybody else probably saw.
So that was a great interview. Thanks to Chris for making us sound good and intelligent.
So I guess your homework this week is to rate us on iTunes and also to just be positive in life and on social media. So turn on, tune in, and be positive.
So just go to social media and share positive things. And share positive things with us on social media at DefectivesPod on Twitter. And you can email us at crimefriction@gmail.com.
Great.
Oh, and also, yes, do rate us. 5 stars. Nothing else, 5 stars. Did we say thanks to Chris? We did, didn't we?
Yeah.
Okay.
He knows we love him.
There we go. That'll do.
We gotta stay positive.